we would like to send out a special thanks to ReadySlim for supporting The Trail Went Cold. ReadySlim focuses on providing the highest quality detox and keto products fit for any busy lifestyle. To save 25% on your first order of ReadySlim's 28-day detox tea kit for a limited time and get a free collapsible water bottle, go to readyslim.com/cold. That's readyslim.com/cold. And we would also like to thank Manly Bands for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Manly Bands helps men find wedding bands that fit their personality and their budget with unique and stylish designs. To get 25% off your Manly Band for a limited time and get a free silicone ring, go to manlybands.com/cold. manlybands.com/cold. Thank you, and enjoy the episode.
March 1st, 1976, Bethesda, Maryland. 37-year-old Annette Bishop, her 68-year-old mother-in-law Lobelia Bishop, and Annette's three sons, 14-year-old Brad, 10-year-old Brent, and 5-year-old Jeffrey, are all bludgeoned to death inside their home. The following day, the victims' burning bodies are discovered in a remote area of North Carolina, but the family's patriarch, 39-year-old William Bradford Bishop, is missing. Since the evidence shows that Bishop committed the crime, he is indicted on 5 counts of murder and becomes a wanted fugitive. But even though there are a number of reported sightings of him over the years, Bishop is never found, and he remains a wanted fugitive. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be presenting a very special episode about a family annihilation and a wanted fugitive, the 1976 murders of the Bishop family. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Matt Smith, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Matt. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been holding for 4 years now, and if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, today's story is the case Matt requested I cover when he originally entered the contest, and I've received a number of requests to do an episode about this since the inception of The Trail Went Cold. But even though it involves the murders of 5 people, there is no mystery about who the perpetrator was. The big unanswered questions are what actually happened to him, and if he's still alive somewhere today. William Bradford Bishop was a State Department employee who murdered his wife, mother, and 3 sons inside their residence before he drove their bodies about 275 miles to a wooded area in another state and proceeded to set them on fire. However, even though the victims were immediately discovered, it took the authorities over a week to put 2 and 2 together and figure out who they were, so while Bishop was eventually indicted on 5 counts of murder, he got a lengthy head start at evading the authorities. Since Bishop's abandoned car was discovered at a campground at Great Smoky Mountains National Park in Tennessee, there has been a lot of debate about whether he managed to flee the country and start a new life, or if he might have simply wandered into the woods and killed himself, and no one has ever found his remains. Over the years, there have been a couple of sightings of Bishop in Europe from witnesses who knew him personally, and from 2014 until 2018, the FBI placed Bishop on their 10 most wanted fugitives list, which suggests they had reason to believe he was still alive at that point. It's not often that The Trail Went Cold covers cases about fugitives who have never been caught, but this is a very complex story which has featured a number of surprising and unlikely developments, so there are definitely a lot of mysterious details to explore on this episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download in several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the Bishop family murders. Our story begins in 1976 in Bethesda, Maryland, an unincorporated community in Montgomery County, located just northwest of Washington, D.C. Our central figure is 39-year-old William Bradford Bishop Jr., who goes by the name Brad, and is currently employed by the State Department as the Assistant Chief in the Division of Special Activities and Commercial Treaties. Brad and his 37-year-old wife, Annette Weiss Bishop, were high school sweethearts and have been married for nearly 17 years at this point. The couple have three sons, including 14-year-old William Bradford Bishop III, who also goes by Brad, 10-year-old Brenton, who goes by Brent, and 5-year-old Jeffrey. The family's residence is located in the Cardrock Springs District, and Brad's 68-year-old mother, Lobelia Bishop, has been living with them since her husband, William Bradford Bishop Sr., passed away in 1969. Brad was originally born in South Pasadena, California, as the only child in his family, and shortly after graduating from Yale University with a Bachelor of Science degree in history, he married Annette, and the couple would spend the next decade moving around several times and living in a number of different countries. After Brad decided to join the Army, he would spend the next 4 years working in counterintelligence and was assigned to a military intelligence battalion in Italy only 10 days after his first son was born, so the family would relocate there. Brad became fluent in no less than 5 different languages, including English, Italian, French, Spanish, and Serbo-Croatian, so one of his responsibilities in counterintelligence involved translating Serbo-Croatian publications and listening to Yugoslavian radio broadcasts. When his 4-year enlistment came to an end, Brad received an honorable discharge from the Army and returned to the United States, where he decided to take a job with the State Department. After joining their Foreign Service program, Brad subsequently received postings as a Foreign Service officer at various American embassies in such countries as Italy, Ethiopia, and Botswana. While the family constantly moved around, Annette gave birth to 2 more sons, but in 1974, they would return to the United States and settled in Bethesda after Brad was assigned to work at the official State Department headquarters located in Washington's Foggy Bottom neighborhood. He would remain in that position for nearly 2 years, but it seemed obvious that Brad was hoping to receive another foreign posting and move overseas again. On March the 1st, the State Department's annual promotion list came out, and Bishop was disappointed to see that he did not receive a promotion he had been seeking. Bishop soon told his supervisor that he was not feeling well and leaving work early. While exiting the building, Bishop crossed paths with one of his co-workers, another Foreign Service officer named Roy Harrell. Bishop openly expressed his frustration about not getting the promotion and told Harrell that he believed he was getting the flu. The two men then parted ways, but sometime over the course of the next several hours, a horrific crime would take place. At 12:40 p.m. the following day, about 275 miles southeast of Bethesda, a state park ranger in Terrell County, North Carolina, responded to a report of a brush fire in a densely wooded swamp area next to a remote logging road located about 5 miles outside the small town of Columbia. The fire had been started inside a freshly dug shallow hole, and a number of items, including an empty gas can, a pitchfork, and a shovel, were resting beside it. When the ranger doused the flames, he was shocked to discover a pile of partially charred bodies inside the hole. After police arrived at the scene and removed the bodies, they determined that there was a total of 5 victims, 2 of whom were adult females, and 3 who appeared to be young boys. Since there were no missing persons reports on file for anyone matching the victims' descriptions, it seemed likely they were not from the area, but the most promising clue was a partial price tag on the shovel, which contained the letters OCH space HDW. The label was soon traced back to an establishment in Potomac, Maryland, named Pox Hardware Store, but at the time, there were still no reports of any missing persons from that area. However, on March the 8th, 6 days after the bodies were found, Lieutenant Joe Sargent of the Montgomery County Police Department was summoned to the Bishop residence in Bethesda after they received a concerned call from the bishop's next-door neighbor. When Sargent arrived, the neighbor told him that she had not seen the Bishop family for an entire week. The family owned two vehicles, but their 1974 Chevrolet Malibu station wagon was missing, and their family dog, a golden retriever named Leo, was also not at the house. Even though it was not uncommon for the bishops to leave on extended trips, the neighbor found it concerning that they had not asked her to collect their newspapers and mail, which were piling up at the house. When he approached the residence, Sargent noticed that there appeared to be blood droplets on the front step, and when he went inside, he discovered more blood droplets on the floor, which led from the doorway through the foyer to a set of stairs. As Sargent walked upstairs, he started noticing blood spatter on the wall, and when he arrived at the entrance to one of the bedrooms, he saw that pretty much the entire ceiling and the walls were covered in blood. It seemed obvious that a massacre had taken place, but there was no sign of the Bishop family. Well, it wasn't long before the Montgomery County PD learned about the 5 burned bodies which had been discovered in North Carolina and put 2 and 2 together. Dental records would soon positively identify the 2 female victims as Annette and Lobelia Bishop, and the 3 boys as Brent, Jeffrey, and Brad III, and it was apparent that they had all been bludgeoned to death with a blood instrument. The family's patriarch, William Bradford Bishop, was nowhere to be found, but there was enough compelling evidence, including his fingerprint on the gas can found next to the bodies, to indicate that he was likely the perpetrator and not an additional victim. On March the 18th, a park ranger finally discovered the bishop's abandoned Chevrolet station wagon near the town of Gatlinburg, Tennessee. It was in the parking lot for the Elkmont Campground, which was a part of the 522,000-acre Great Smoky Mountains National Park. This location was in close proximity to the Tennessee-North Carolina state line and nearly 500 miles west from the spot where the Bishop family's bodies had been found. The spare tire well in the station wagon's trunk was stained with dried blood, and a number of items were inside the vehicle, including a bloody blanket, a shotgun, shotgun shells, an axe, some dog biscuits, and a shaving kit containing an anti-anxiety medication Brad had been taking called Cerax. By the time the station wagon was discovered, the authorities had already been backtracking Bishop's movements since he was seen leaving the State Department headquarters on March the 1st. That same day, Bishop had gone to a bank and emptied out his family's account by withdrawing $400 before he went to a Sears department store at the Montgomery Mall to purchase a ball-peen hammer and an empty gas can. He then stopped at a gas station to fill up both the gas can and the station wagon's fuel tank before he drove to Pox Hardware Store in Potomac, which is where he bought the pitchfork and the shovel, which contained the store's partially torn price tag. Bishop returned to his residence that evening, and based on the physical evidence at the scene, here is what investigators believe happened. It's likely that Brad used the ball-peen hammer to bludgeon Annette first while she was in the study. Since a notebook Annette had written was found in a pool of blood, she may have been attacked while she was reading it. There was also blood evidence in the master bedroom to indicate that Brad may have taken Annette's body in there and placed it on the bed. Neighbors recalled having seen Lobelia walking the dog on the evening of March the 1st, so the attack on Annette probably took place while Lobelia was out of the house, and she was attacked shortly after she returned. Since blood was found in the bathroom and the door was kicked in, Lobelia might have figured out what happened and attempted to hide from her son before he broke inside and bludgeoned her. Lobelia's injuries were less severe than the other victims, so she may have technically been smothered or frightened to death. Since all 3 of the Bishop boys had been found wearing pajamas, they likely went to bed before the attacks occurred. At the time, the 2 youngest children, Brent and Jeffrey, shared a bedroom and slept in bunk beds, while Brad III had his own room. There was so much blood inside their respective bedrooms that Brad clearly bludgeoned his 3 boys repeatedly with the hammer while they were in the beds, and hammer marks were found in the ceiling above the top bunk bed. After wrapping all five bodies with blankets and towels and loading them into the back of the family station wagon, Brad then spent the entire night driving to Terrell County before he stopped at a wooded area next to a remote logging road sometime during the late morning. He then proceeded to dig a hole and dumped his family's bodies in there before dousing them with the gasoline and setting them on fire. It turned out that later that same day, Brad's credit card was used to buy a pair of tennis shoes at a sporting goods store in Jacksonville, North Carolina, located about 130 miles south. Bishop's signature was on the credit card receipt, and the store owner would confirm that he had made the purchase. But interestingly enough, the owner also said that he saw a woman, whom he described as dark-skinned, standing outside the door with a dog on a leash. Even though the dog was described as being an Irish setter, and the Bishop family dog, Leo, was a golden retriever, Leo had a dark red coat and could have easily been mistaken for an Irish setter. The owner also said he saw Bishop interacting with the woman, and he got the impression they were a couple. At some point, Bishop presumably drove the station wagon to the Elkmont campground, and at least one witness told investigators that the earliest they could recall seeing it parked there was on March the 6th. Even though a number of items were inside the abandoned station wagon, the actual murder weapon, the ball-peen hammer, was never found. Due to Brad's numerous overseas postings over the years, the entire Bishop family had diplomatic passports which were found at the residence, but Brad's passport, as well as his wallet, could not be accounted for. A .38-caliber Smith & Wesson revolver, which Brad had inherited from his father, was also missing from the residence, leading to speculation that he might have been carrying it with him when he disappeared. On March the 19th, the day after the station wagon was discovered, a grand jury indicted Bishop on 5 counts of first-degree murder, and he became a wanted fugitive who would be pursued by the FBI, the United States Marshals, and Interpol. The Elkmont campground parking lot was only a few miles from the Appalachian Trail, but even though over 300 hikers and campers who had walked the trail during this time period were interviewed, none of them recalled seeing Bishop. A man resembling Bishop had been seen at the nearby Sugarlands Visitor Center around that time period, where he asked for a park map and directions to Elkmont, since he said he had enjoyed camping there before and wanted to go back. Well, a police bloodhound was able to pick up Bishop's faint scent at the visitor center and failed to lead them anywhere, and even though an extensive search was performed of Great Smoky Mountains National Park, Bishop could not be found. However, weeks after the search concluded, an interesting discovery was made by park ranger Dwight McCarter, who was informed by an acquaintance about a makeshift grave at a spot near the Newt Prong Stream, about a mile away from the Elkmont parking lot. When McCarter checked the area, he did find a small grave, which was marked by a pile of rocks and a wooden cross that appeared to have been tied together by a parachute cord. McCarter took photos of the grave, but he apparently never tried to dig it up or inform the authorities about it, and since the site has become overgrown over the years, the grave can no longer be found. Since Bishop's dog Leo was never located, there has been speculation that the grave might have belonged to him. A number of theories circulated about what drove Bishop to murder his family. Brad had a long history of insomnia and depression, and had been seeing a psychiatrist twice a week, who prescribed him the anti-anxiety medication Xarax. He had expressed his dislike about working a desk job at the State Department headquarters and was hoping for another overseas posting in a foreign country. But after constantly moving her family around for years to further her husband's career, Annette had become content to settle into a stable suburban lifestyle and had no desire to relocate again. Even though Brad had wanted Annette to remain a stay-at-home mom, she gained more flexibility when Brad's mother, Lobelia, moved in with the family. Since Lobelia often took over Annette's household responsibilities and helped care for the children, Annette now had more time to pursue her own interests, and she began studying art at the University of Maryland, which seemed to cause tension in the marriage. At the time of the murders, the family was also facing financial pressures, and the IRS was in the midst of auditing their taxes. Since the cost of living near Washington, D.C. was higher than the cost of living overseas, Brad often relied on his mother to help finance the family's lifestyle, since she had received a considerable inheritance after her husband passed away. Lobelia had even provided the family with a $30,000 down payment to purchase their home, but her money was starting to run out. On the morning of the murders, Annette had spoken to an acquaintance and said that she needed to find work because of the family's financial issues. It was speculated that Brad's failure to make the State Department's annual promotion list that day may have been the breaking point which drove him to commit such an unthinkable crime. Since Brad had a one-week head start, before anyone even realized his family was murdered, and he had extensive experience working and living overseas and speaking a number of different languages, it seemed plausible that he could have skipped the country. Over the years, there would be a number of reported eyewitness sightings of Bishop, but three of them stood out and were deemed to be credible by the authorities since they took place in Europe and involved witnesses who knew Bishop personally. The first of these sightings occurred in July of 1978 and involved a Swedish woman who had previously worked with Bishop when he was posted in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. On separate occasions within the span of 1 week, the woman claimed she saw a bearded man resembling Bishop at a public park in Stockholm, and she believed he was following her. At the time, the woman was not yet aware that Bishop had become a wanted fugitive, but once she found out, she reported her sightings to the authorities. The next sighting occurred 6 months later in January of 1979 and involved Roy Harrell, Bishop's former colleague from the State Department who had bumped into him as he was leaving work on the day of the murders. Harrell was on a trip to Italy and visited the Piazza Tasso Square in the town of Sorrento in order to board a bus to Rome. While there, Harrell went into a restroom, and it wasn't long before a disheveled-looking man who looked like a vagrant walked inside. Even though the man had shaggy hair and a beard, Harrell thought he had a striking resemblance to Bishop. Harrell claimed that he actually said, "You're Brad Bishop, aren't you?" And this caused the man to panic and yell out, "Oh God, no," in what sounded like an American accent. The man sprinted out of the restroom, and Harrell made an attempt to chase after him, but said that he lost the man when he disappeared down some cliffs heading towards a boat landing. The third sighting took place on September the 19th, 1994, on a train platform in Basel, Switzerland, and the witness was a former neighbor of the Bishop family from Bethesda who was on vacation with her husband. The witness said they noticed Bishop through the window of a train on a different platform and that he made direct eye contact and appeared to laugh as his train pulled away. Unlike the sighting from Roy Harrell in Italy, Bishop was described as looking, quote-unquote, well-groomed. Well, in spite of these sightings, investigators never found any conclusive evidence to prove that Bishop was still alive somewhere, but his case received a lot of national exposure during the early 1990s when it was featured on such true crime shows as Unsolved Mysteries and America's Most Wanted. In fact, a surprising development would take place in September of 1992 when investigators decided to check Bishop's original personnel file from the State Department and discovered a letter written to him by a federal inmate named Albert Kenneth Bankston, who had once been incarcerated at the United States Penitentiary Marion in Williamson County, Illinois, for bank robbery. The letter was postmarked March 15, 1976, 2 weeks after the murders took place, and since Bankston made references to letter number 4 and letter number 5, and wrote the number 6 near the top of the page, this seemed to indicate that he and Bishop had already corresponded on multiple occasions. While the letter made no direct reference to murder, it hinted at the possibility that Bishop may have been attempting to hire someone to kill his family. In one passage, Bankston wrote, quote, "Yes, I am most sure she is in the North Carolina State Penitentiary. I do not know why Sonny would tell you something that could very easily be proved. When I wrote you in February, letter number 5, I explained that she was there, and that David Paul Allen knew this Sonny in Atlanta. I am sure he is a capable person, and that he knows all about Creswell. In fact, David said you could walk to Phelps Lake from Creswell, I think it's about 5 miles, end quote. Well, interestingly enough, Creswell and Phelps Lakes were both locations in North Carolina that were in fairly close proximity to the location where the Bishop family's bodies were discovered. The letter also contained a line, quote, "I was only interested in Mexico and or Central America, as you know," which made investigators theorize that Bishop may have been planning to use his connections to provide Bankston with a fake passport in exchange for putting him in touch with some criminal associates. The letter had been sent directly to Bishop's office at the State Department headquarters, but the authorities had already performed a search of his office on the same day the letter was postmarked. It's believed that when the letter arrived a few days later, a secretary may have opened it and placed it inside Bishop's personnel file before his belongings were packed up, which is why investigators did not find it for 16 years. Unfortunately, since Bankston died of cancer in 1983, he could not be questioned about the contents of the letter. However, investigators were able to track down and speak with one of the men referenced in the letter, David Paul Allen, a career criminal who had served time in several different prisons. While Allen claimed to have no direct knowledge of the crime, he claimed that he had once heard about a murder-for-hire plot in which a man named Bishop was planning to pay $25,000 in cash as well as some jewelry to have his entire family murdered. This crime was supposed to take place while Bishop was out of the country, but when he returned home, he was disappointed to discover that the contractors did not complete the job and kept his money. Well, it turned out that Bishop had been away on a business trip to Geneva, Switzerland, from January the 27th until February the 6th of 1976, 1 month before he committed the murders. Investigators were also able to track down the man referenced in the letter known only as Sonny, who was living in witness protection under a new name at that point. Sonny denied knowing anything about a murder-for-hire plot, though he did hint that if Bishop had paid someone to kill his family, they may have elected not to go through with it due to the refusal to murder children. Bankston's reference to an unnamed woman from the North Carolina State Penitentiary was also intriguing, particularly since Bishop had supposedly been sighted with a woman at the sporting goods store in Jacksonville. But even though investigators checked into a number of women who were released from North Carolina prisons during that time period, they were unable to determine whom Bankston might have been referring to. However, it's worth noting that Bishop had reportedly been seen on the ski slopes with an unidentified woman during his aforementioned business trip to Switzerland. Another surprising development took place in March of 2000, when a North Carolina woman wound up purchasing an old diary at a flea market at the Greensboro Coliseum and contacted the authorities when she saw the words Bradford Bishop Diary on the front page. Indeed, the entries in the diary were dated from October of 1965 until October of 1971, and they matched Bishop's handwriting and contained enough specific details about his life to indicate that he actually wrote them. As the years went on, Bishop's writing in the diary became progressively more disjointed, which suggested that he was heading on a downward spiral towards a dark place. The words 776 Colonel James Auction were written in the diary, and the contents of the Bishop home had been auctioned off at the Colonel James Auction Gallery in College Park, Maryland in July of 1976, though how the diary wound up at a flea market in North Carolina has never been determined. In April of 2014, the FBI announced that they were officially adding Bishop to their 10 most wanted fugitives list for the very first time. Even though Bishop would have been 77 years old at that point, investigators expressed their belief that he might still be alive and possibly living in plain sight in the United States. They even asked noted forensic artist Karen Taylor to create an age progression sculpture of Bishop's head in order to showcase what he might look like after all these years. The addition of Bishop to the 10 most wanted list seemed to reignite the investigation and created a ton of additional publicity for the case. And later that summer, Bishop would be featured on an episode of The Hunt, a new true crime series hosted by John Walsh, which sought to capture wanted fugitives. In October of that year, the FBI exhumed the body of an unidentified John Doe who had been fatally struck by a car while walking along Highway 72 near Scottsboro, Alabama, in October of 1981. A local resident had seen a photograph of the John Doe and thought he bore a striking resemblance to William Bradford Bishop and decided to notify the authorities. By this point, DNA had been extracted from the shaving kit found in Bishop's station wagon in order to create a profile for him, but when his DNA was compared to the John Doe, it turned out not to be a match. Bishop continued to remain on the 10 most wanted list for the next 4 years, until the FBI decided to remove him in June of 2018. They said they no longer believed publicity would aid in Bishop's capture, and wanted to give his spot on the list to another fugitive, though they assured the public that they would not stop searching for him. But earlier this year, in March of 2021, there would be one more bizarre postscript to this story when a 63-year-old woman named Kathy Gilchrist discovered that William Bradford Bishop was her biological father. Shortly after she was born in 1957, Kathy had been put up for adoption, but as she got older, she felt compelled to find out who her biological parents were, and DNA testing would eventually link her to Bishop. The identity of Kathy's biological mother has never been released publicly, but she passed away during the spring of 2020. The circumstances of how this woman became involved with Bishop are unclear, but Kathy would have been conceived during the time period when he was a student at Yale University. If he is still alive, William Bradford Bishop would have turned 85 years old just a few weeks before this episode's release, but he has never been tracked down and continues to remain one of the world's most infamous wanted fugitives. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to talk about ReadySlim. ReadySlim is a wellness company that focuses on providing the highest quality detox and keto products fit for any busy lifestyle. When you're sitting down constantly writing and researching a podcast, you're obviously not going to be spending that time on physical activity, so it helps to find some good beverages to sustain you, such as ReadySlim, whose detox teas are made with high quality, 100% organic herbs and no fillers, no additives, and no laxatives, so they're safe to drink daily. They gently boost your metabolism and help with digestion while also reducing bloating. ReadySlim's 28-day detox tea kit has everything you need and offers some very important options, the Wakey Wakey Morning Detox Tea and Snoozy Night Detox Tea. ReadySlim also helps aid in weight loss and is keto-friendly. I'm a guy who often likes to drink tea while I'm working on podcast scripts, but I recently started using ReadySlim and it's been working wonders. If I feel like I need a boost of energy, I help myself to the Wakey Wakey Morning Detox Tea, but if I'm working at night, I sometimes get so energized that I can't unwind and go to bed, and that's when I select the Snoozy Night Detox Tea, which helps you relax and supports the natural detox process while you get your well-deserved beauty sleep. I do appreciate that ReadySlim offers both these options for different situations, and it's helped improve my digestion and is allowing me to sleep better at night. So to save 25% on your first order of ReadySlim's 28-day detox tea kit for a limited time, go to readyslim.com/cold. You'll also get a free collapsible water bottle. That's readyslim.com/cold to save 25% on your first purchase of ReadySlim's 28-day detox tea kit plus a free collapsible water bottle. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. This week's episode is also brought to you by Manly Bands, which helps men find wedding bands that fit their personality and their budget with unique and stylish designs. So if you want to get your personalized Manly Band, here's how the process works. You first get their Manly Ring Sizer to ensure that it will fit you perfectly during work and play. Once you know your size, then comes the fun of choosing from their wide selection of materials like gold, wood, antler, steel, and even dinosaur bone. I mean, you can also choose from one of Manly Band's curated collections, such as the Jack Daniel's Whiskey Barrel Collection. And once you've selected your band, you get free shipping worldwide, a 30-day exchange policy, and a free warranty. I can tell you that one individual who greatly appreciates Manly Bands is our podcast's very own editor/producer, McGill. Over 5 years ago, McGill got married to his wife Caitlin, but they could not afford wedding rings for each other. While Caitlin currently wears a ring that her mother made her as a wedding ring, McGill did not have one until he came across Manly Bands, where he ordered a black zirconium known as the Fitzgerald, which has 14K rose gold plating on the sides. McGill is very proud to be able to wear this, but even if you do already have your own wedding band, it's still a fun and cool idea to get another one, which perfectly suits your personality, and you can switch them up for different activities. As an example, if you're a baseball fan, they offer a band called the World Series, where you can feature the logo of your favorite team. So to get 25% off your Manly Band for a limited time, go to manlybands.com/cold. Plus, you'll get a free silicone ring. That's manlybands.com/cold for 25% off for a limited time. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. So like I mentioned in the intro, this is an unsolved case in which there's no mystery about who actually committed the crime, but there's still a number of unanswered questions which can be discussed on this episode. However, I should mention that if you research this case, you're going to come across conspiracy theories which explore the possibility that an outside party might have murdered the entire Bishop family and made Brad's body disappear in order to frame him for the crime. I suppose it's inevitable there would be theories like this, considering that Brad was a government employee who spent time in a number of different countries and did counterintelligence work in the army prior to joining the State Department. In fact, there have been allegations that the State Department job was just a cover, and that Bishop may have been a spy who worked for the CIA. Well, of course, the State Department and the CIA have always denied this, and I've seen nothing to indicate that Bishop was involved in anything clandestine. His counterintelligence work mostly consisted of such mundane tasks as translating Serbo-Croatian publications and radio broadcasts. In fact, the most exciting assignment Brad ever told people about is how he was once supposedly put in charge of infiltrating a Yugoslavian ski team which had traveled to Italy in order to recruit spies. But I don't think this assignment ever went anywhere, and it certainly doesn't sound like the type of thing which might compel foreign nationals to murder his entire family. During the early stages of his career with the Foreign Service, Bishop was actually given an unflattering security evaluation because he was often admonished for such poor practices as failing to properly secure classified information, and at one point, he said it seemed like, quote-unquote, too much bother to do that. During this evaluation, Bishop was graded as being weak at judgment, flexibility, and ability to apply common sense, so while I'm sure he was skilled at certain aspects of his job, he did not seem like an ideal candidate for espionage work. The fact of the matter is that Brad was the one who purchased all the items which were used in the commission of this crime, such as the ball-peen hammer, gasoline can, and shovel, and there was ample physical evidence to indict him for the murders. I mean, there was a confirmed eyewitness sighting of Brad purchasing tennis shoes at a sporting goods store in Jacksonville, so unless he had a convincing doppelganger who used his credit card and forged his signature, this proves that Brad was still alive after his family's bodies were set on fire. If contract killers wanted to wipe out the Bishop family and frame Brad, there are far easier ways to do so than bludgeoning five people with a small hammer and transporting their bodies 275 miles. Many people who worked this case have stated that one of the most chilling details were the numerous hammer marks found in the ceiling above the top bunk bed in the bedroom belonging to Brent and Jeffrey Bishop. This suggests a perpetrator who was experiencing immense personal rage as they bludgeoned two children to death, not a professional assassin attempting to orchestrate an elaborate frame-up job. Unless Brad is caught someday and shares his version of events, we may never know the full truth behind his motive for the crime, but there is ample evidence to show that he was an arrogant narcissist and had been a ticking time bomb for quite some time. He always loved to give off the impression of being the patriarch of a perfect family who lived the most successful life possible, but after spending years traveling the world and being assigned to different postings in different countries, it's obvious that Brad considered a permanent desk job in Washington, D.C. to be his worst nightmare. If you worked in the Foreign Service during that time period, going through long periods of time without a promotion was very detrimental to your career, and Brad had experienced no upward mobility for nearly 2 years at that point. He also seemed to find it frustrating that Annette was content to provide her family with a stable, permanent life in the suburbs, and she had no desire to relocate to another overseas posting. The discovery of Brad's diary at a flea market 24 years after the murder was a pretty bizarre development in this story, but it provides a very vivid look at Brad's mindset. The last entry was written over 4 years before the crime, at a time when Brad still seemed to be living the ideal life, so you can only imagine how discontented he must have been in 1976. Brad's failure to make the State Department's annual promotion list has often been cited as the breaking point which prompted him to kill his entire family, but he seemed to be in such a dark place that it was probably inevitable that he would snap. As if this case wasn't extraordinary enough, there's also another bizarre side story involving one of the world's most renowned ballet dancers, Jacques d'Amboise, who passed away earlier this year in May of 2021. When d'Amboise was 17 years old, he joined a traveling ballet troupe which operated near South Pasadena, California, so arrangements were made for him to stay with the Bishop family, as Lobelia Bishop and her husband were big ballet fans. At the time, Brad was 14 years old, and D'Amboise often played chess with him. As the years went on, and D'Amboise's ballet career flourished, he maintained contact with the Bishop family, and in 1976, he was scheduled to perform at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. Lobelia invited Jacques and his wife Carrie to spend the night at the Bishop residence in Bethesda on the evening of February the 29th, but at the last minute, Jacques suffered a foot injury and was forced to cancel his performance. Well, if this injury had not occurred, Jacques and Carrie likely still would have been present at the residence on March the 1st when the murders took place. As you can imagine, Jacques has always wondered if his presence at the house that night might have prevented the crime, or if he and his wife would have become victims, too. Well, sadly, even if Brad had elected not to murder his family on that particular date, it probably would have happened at some point down the line. And of course, it was a big shock earlier this year when DNA testing revealed that Brad had conceived a daughter with another woman during the 1950s, and I cannot imagine what it must have felt like for Kathy Gilchrist to spend years searching for her biological father, only to discover that he was a wanted family annihilator. We'll probably never know the circumstances of how Brad met Kathy's mother, or if he even found out that she was pregnant and gave birth to his child, but even though Brad and Annette were not yet married by that point, they had been in a relationship since high school, so Brad technically did cheat on her, which says a lot about his character. So I first became familiar with the Bishop case when it was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and this is not the only case the show has covered about a family annihilator who became a wanted fugitive. They also profiled the story of Robert William Fisher, who murdered his wife and two children in Arizona in April of 2001, and he is still on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list to this day. And last year, the Unsolved Mysteries reboot on Netflix produced an episode about Xavier Dupont de Ligonnès, who has been a wanted fugitive since April of 2011 after he murdered his wife and four children at their residence in Nantes, France. Much like Bishop, both these men abandoned their vehicles before they disappeared, and it's possible that they could have wandered off into a remote area somewhere to kill themselves, and the remains have simply never been found. Of course, since Bishop abandoned his car at Great Smoky Mountains National Park, it's certainly possible that the exact same thing happened to him. But the key difference is that it's a lot more difficult to disappear and start a new life under a new identity in the 21st century than it was back in 1976. Couple in the fact that Bishop got a major head start before a warrant was issued for his arrest, and he also had extensive experience working and living in other countries and spoke a number of different languages, then it's not implausible that he could have successfully escaped the United States and has managed to remain in hiding ever since. Of course, I'm sure a number of you are already familiar with John List, another notorious family annihilator who became a wanted fugitive during this time period, and there's so many parallels you can make between his case and the Bishop murders. This particular crime took place in Westfield, New Jersey on November the 9th, 1971, and like Bishop, List murdered his wife, mother, and three children inside their residence before he went on the run. Since it was nearly a month before the authorities even found out that this crime occurred, List was able to successfully disappear and start a new life under a new identity, and even got remarried years later. In May of 1989, List was profiled on an episode of America's Most Wanted, and they featured an age-progressed clay bust of List's head to show what he might look like over 17 years later. Well, the strategy paid off, as a former neighbor of List's recognized him, and he was tracked down in Virginia and arrested less than 2 weeks after the original broadcast. He was subsequently convicted on 5 counts of first-degree murder and died in prison in 2008. If List managed to hide out in the United States for so many years, then it's certainly not impossible that Bishop could have done the same thing, particularly if he skipped the country. Given the circumstances of how List was caught, you can understand why an age progression sculpture was created for Bishop in 2014, but thus far, lightning has not struck twice. I can definitely see compelling arguments for Bishop either successfully escaping to another country and starting a new life, or him simply wandering into Great Smoky Mountains National Park and killing himself. However, I cannot overlook the fact that Bishop was not added to the FBI's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list until 2014. Given what a heinous crime this was, I'm actually surprised that Bishop was never added to the list way back during the 1970s, so why would they wait until he was 77 years old? That's an age when criminals are generally removed from the most wanted list if they haven't been found, not added there for the first time. While the authorities have always been very tight-lipped about it, I have to think they received compelling information to make them believe Bishop was still alive at that point and could still be captured and brought to justice. But let's look at the circumstances of how this crime was carried out. I suppose none of us can truly understand the mindset of a family annihilator, but what differentiates Bishop from the likes of John List, Robert William Fisher, and Xavier Dupont de Leganes is that he went to the trouble of loading his murdered family's bodies into his vehicle before driving from Maryland to North Carolina. I cannot imagine how one could work up the will to make an all-night road trip under those circumstances. Now, if Bishop was planning to orchestrate an escape, I can understand him wanting to bury the bodies at a faraway location to throw off the investigation, but he decided to call attention to himself by setting the bodies on fire, which was a pretty huge risk, since it sounds like the park ranger may have arrived at the scene only minutes after Bishop left. I've always wondered how people would view this case today if the bodies had been completely buried and were never found, and this was technically still a missing persons case. Yes, the massive amounts of blood at the Bishop residence would show that the family were victims of foul play, but without any bodies, would investigators assume that Brad had been murdered too by an outside party? Brad also didn't seem to have any qualms about leaving items next to the hole which could be traced back to him, such as the gas can, pitchfork, and shovel. So it seems pretty clear to me that he wanted his family's bodies to be found and for everyone to know what he did, though whether or not he still hoped to escape and get away with it is unclear. Of course, the location where the bodies were burned was on a remote logging road, and investigators have stated that it's very unlikely Bishop could have found this spot by pure chance unless he had some familiarity with the area. It's unclear if Bishop had ever traveled to Terrell County before, but the letter from Albert Kenneth Bankston makes reference to a pair of locations which were in very close proximity to this spot. We'll talk more about that letter momentarily, but first let's address the last confirmed sighting of Bishop, where he used his credit card to purchase tennis shoes at a sporting goods store in Jacksonville. Given that his car was later found at Great Smoky Mountains National Park, it's possible that Bishop bought these shoes to prepare for a hike on one of the trails, but he might have also done this out of necessity if the shoes he was previously wearing had incriminating evidence like blood on them. But the most interesting detail about the sighting is the dark-skinned woman seen standing with a dog on a leash, which may have been the Bishop's missing golden retriever, Leo. I mean, I guess it's possible this woman was a stranger, and Bishop just asked her to watch over his dog while he went inside the store, but the owner seemed to think they were a couple. Once again, this harkens back to the letter from Albert Kenneth Bankston, where he mentioned an unidentified woman in the North Carolina State Penitentiary. But if Bishop and this woman knew each other, was she his secret mistress, or was she there to help him make a successful escape? Indeed, Bishop withdrew around $400 from his bank account, which is hardly enough to make a fresh start, and the spot where he abandoned his station wagon was not exactly in close proximity to the nearest airport. After driving 130 miles southeast from Terrell County to Jacksonville, it's unclear why Bishop decided to change direction and make a 450-mile drive northwest to the Elkmont campground. Was there any significance to this particular location? If Bishop was always planning suicide, perhaps he felt that Great Smoky Mountains National Park was a peaceful place to end his life. Remember, a Smith & Wesson revolver he owned was missing from the Bishop residence and was never accounted for, so if he walked into the woods and shot himself and animals scattered his remains, you can understand why an extensive search effort failed to find him, as we're talking about a park which encompasses over 520,000 acres. In fact, since Bishop was an avid outdoorsman, perhaps he intended to hide out there for a while, but ultimately died of exposure. And then there's the matter of the missing dog, Leo, whose whereabouts have never been accounted for. It sounds like Bishop really loved that dog, though there's definitely something unsettling about the idea of him annihilating his entire family and letting Leo ride in the station wagon with the dead bodies. I know a lot of you folks out there are dog lovers, but unfortunately, I have to say there's a decent chance that Leo wound up buried in that makeshift grave in the park. I had no idea this grave even existed until Park Ranger Dwight McCarter mentioned it during a news segment, which was produced about the case by WBIR-TV in Knoxville in February of 2018. Since McCarter took photos of the grave, we know it actually existed, but it's very frustrating that he never did anything else about it, and the grave can no longer be found today. If Bishop did in fact kill Leo and bury him there, that could be taken as a sign that he was planning to kill himself, but on the other hand, if he was planning to flee the country on an airplane, it would have been difficult to take Leo with him. But once again, it's pretty unsettling that he would give Leo the dignity of a proper burial after placing the bodies of his wife, mother, and children in a hole and setting them on fire. One more detail which does suggest that Bishop may have been suicidal was that the anti-anxiety medication he was taking, Xarax, was left behind in his car, and if he went for a long period of time without taking it, he likely would have become incredibly depressed. But if Bishop did want to flee the area after abandoning the station wagon, he would have had to hitch a ride, and I don't see any indication that there were any reports of someone picking up a hitchhiker matching his description during that time period. Or alternatively, the dark-skinned woman seen with Bishop in Jacksonville gave him a ride or arranged for some alternate transportation. And this is where the letter from Albert Kenneth Bankston comes into play, as it makes you wonder just how much pre-planning went into this crime, and if Bishop had attempted to hire someone to murder his family for him. Obviously, it's a major shame this letter wasn't discovered until 1992, nearly a full decade after Bankston died, because there are a lot of details in there which need more context. Now, I will admit the possibility that the letter could be a hoax, as Bankston did have a reputation for constantly looking for an angle in which he could earn himself special privileges or better conditions in prison. This would sometimes involve him writing letters to people from behind bars, and he apparently once tried to falsely insert himself into another murder case which had received a lot of publicity in the press. So theoretically, Bankston could have read about the Bishop murders in the newspapers and then sent a letter to Bishop's office because, well, this is the type of thing convicted criminals sometimes like to do when they're in prison and have a lot of time on their hands. The letter was postmarked on March the 15th, 1976, but while the family's deaths had made the news, Bishop had technically not been indicted yet for the murders. Would an inmate serving time in Illinois have been able to find out the details of this crime, as well as the address of Bishop's office at the State Department, if he hadn't been in contact with them before? Bankston wrote that this was the sixth time he had sent a letter to Bishop, and it reads like he is completely unaware that the murders have taken place and Bishop is missing. If the letter is a hoax, it's a pretty well-crafted one, especially since Bankston specifically made mention of two other locations in Terrell County, only a few miles from the spot where the bodies were found. But on the other hand, how would Bishop have even gotten in contact with someone like Bankston? Bankston made mention of two other individuals, David Paul Allen and a guy known only as Sonny, and while both men claimed to have no knowledge of the crime, it is interesting how Allen shared unsubstantiated rumors about Bishop attempting to orchestrate a murder for hire on his family while he was out of the country. Bishop did take a trip to Switzerland a month before the crime took place, so this does line up with Allen's story, but the one detail which doesn't ring true is that Bishop was supposedly going to pay $25,000 in cash for the job. Bishop's yearly salary at the State Department was just over $25,000, and since he was not in good financial shape at the time, I don't see how he could have gotten his hands on that much money. If Bishop was planning to hire someone to murder his family, then the implication seems to be that he was hoping to get away with it and could just continue living his life. But when that strategy failed, and Bishop realized he would have to perform the act himself, he likely knew that the only options for him were running away to start a new life, or suicide. Now, the fact that Bishop's diplomatic passport was missing from his residence does lend credence to the idea that he was planning to skip the country, but if he used his passport, it's odd that it wouldn't have been flagged anywhere. Apparently, if you make a diplomatic passport to make an unscheduled visit to a foreign country, customs officials are likely going to want to know what you're doing there, particularly since Bishop had not received any official overseas postings in a couple years. But if Bishop made it somewhere before a warrant was issued for his arrest, and he provided a convincing enough story when he entered the country, he might have slipped through undetected. Of course, in any case involving wanted fugitives, there's going to be no shortage of eyewitness sightings, but there are three of them in the Bishop case which really stand out because they were reported by people who knew him personally. Now, since all these sightings took place in European countries, and two of them were made by Americans who were traveling there at the time, it may seem like too much of a coincidence that they would run into Bishop, but that sort of thing does happen. My father is a retired commercial airline pilot who made countless overseas trips during his career, and he has told me about chance encounters where he randomly bumped into people he knew in foreign countries. For a guy who traveled and moved around as much as Bishop did, I could see a scenario like this happening. The sightings of Bishop in Sweden and Switzerland were from a distance, but the incident with Roy Harrell in the restroom in Italy is particularly interesting, since Harrell claimed he directly engaged with Bishop and said his name out loud. If the bearded man Harrell saw was not actually Bishop, it's very odd that he would freak out and run away instead of reacting with confusion. I mean, if this was just some random Italian vagrant, he may not have even spoken or understood English, so Harrell's words would have meant nothing. If Harrell's story is true, then the man's reaction was convincing evidence that he was Bishop and had managed to escape the United States. But the key word here is if, because there may be some credibility issues with Harrell. 6 years ago, journalist Peter Ross Range published a 51-page Kindle book on Amazon about the Bishop case titled A Killer in the Family, which contained a few tidbits of information I had not heard before. Apparently, sometime during the 1990s, investigators began to suspect that Harrell was relishing the attention he received from talking about his association with the Bishop case, so they decided to ask Harrell about Bishop's connection to a certain person of interest. Harrell said he would go check his notes, and the next time he spoke to these investigators, he shared an elaborate story about Bishop's relationship with this person. The only problem? This person did not actually exist, as investigators had completely made up his name in order to test Harrell. So if Harrell was willing to completely fabricate a story about Bishop and a non-existent individual, who's to say he couldn't have fabricated his encounter with Bishop in Italy? Now, this book is the only source I've ever found which shares this tidbit about Harrell, and it's worth noting that he was interviewed and shared the Italy story on the episode of The Hunt, which came out in 2014. So I guess the producers of that show still thought he had credibility. Harrell has since passed away, but I do get the impression that he loved talking about his association with Bishop, as he even made this armchair diagnosis about him during his Unsolved Mysteries interview. Quote, "Brad Bishop felt, from the time I knew him, that there was something lacking in himself. This feeling was nourished constantly by both his mother and to some degree his wife, who constantly told him that he was inadequate and washed up and wasn't going anywhere in his career." End quote. Well, from what I've read, Harrell's claims about Bishop constantly being belittled by his wife and mother sound a bit exaggerated. Regardless of whether or not you believe the sightings from Harrell and the other eyewitnesses, there has never been any concrete evidence to prove that Bishop left the United States in 1976. However, I find it interesting that when Bishop was added to the 10 Most Wanted list in 2014, a number of articles were published which stated that the FBI was searching for him in Southern California, which is where he was originally born. So did they receive information to suggest that Bishop had returned to the United States? Or did he never leave the country to begin with and managed to elude detection for 4 decades? If Bishop originally fled the US and returned there at a later time, that seems incredibly risky, though if he had a fake passport under a new identity, I suppose it would have been easier to pull something like that off during the pre-9/11 era when security restrictions were less tight. During the aforementioned episode of The Hunt, investigators even pushed forward the idea that now that Bishop was in his 70s and not as recognizable, he could have been living in plain sight somewhere and possibly settled into a quiet, menial job where he wouldn't attract attention. I mean, I still remember when the news came out that Bishop might have been an unidentified John Doe who was killed in Alabama in 1981. Side-by-side photos were posted of Bishop and the decedent, and they looked so much alike that I was initially convinced it might be him, but DNA testing proved this wasn't the case. Again, I can't overlook the cyclical nature of the media coverage of this case. There seemed to be renewed effort to find Bishop during the early 1990s, when he was featured on shows like America's Most Wanted and Unsolved Mysteries, but then things went relatively quiet again until he was suddenly added to the 10 Most Wanted list in 2014. The FBI must have had good reason to believe he was still alive, but unfortunately, this new publicity never led to a resolution. The situation may be harkened back to another infamous fugitive, Donald Eugene Webb, who spent nearly 26 years on the 10 Most Wanted list for murdering a small-town police chief named Gregory Adams in December of 1980. The FBI finally decided to remove Webb from the list in 2007, when he would have been a few months shy of his 76th birthday, as the lack of recent leads made them suspect that Webb was probably dead. While their instincts turned out to be correct, as 10 years later, Webb's remains were discovered buried on property belonging to his former wife. It turned out that Webb had spent a good chunk of his time on the run, hiding out in a secret room at his wife's residence until he died of a stroke in 1999 and she buried his body. For the longest time, I figured we might never find out what happened to Webb, so maybe a situation like this will occur with Bishop someday. Even though Bishop has since been removed from the 10 Most Wanted list, the authorities have not stopped looking for him, so who knows what might happen. Somebody might stumble upon his remains in a section of Great Smoky Mountain National Park, or alternatively, we'll learn that Bishop lived for many years under a false identity before he died of natural causes, and it just took a long time to put two and two together. We know that Bishop's DNA profile is on file, as it was recently used to link him to a biological daughter that no one even knew he had, so maybe he'll eventually be linked to an unidentified decedent someday. Part of me kind of hopes that Bishop did kill himself or died shortly after he became a fugitive, because I hate the idea of him getting to live the majority of his life as a free man after committing such a heinous crime. But on the other hand, it would also be satisfying to see this evil monster in handcuffs at some point. He may have just turned 85 years old, but his advanced age should not mean he gets away with it. So I hope he can still be found alive, and that Annette, Lobelia, Brent, Jeffrey, and Brad III finally receive justice. So if you happen to have any information on the whereabouts of William Bradford Bishop, please contact your local FBI office, or if you're outside the United States, get in touch with the nearest American embassy or consulate. Anyway, another special thanks to Matt Smith for narrating the opening of our episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't done so yet, all you need to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about a famous case which was once featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the 1987 attack on Jenny Pratt, who was hit in the back of the head with a 2x4 by the occupants of a speeding truck, a crime which left her with considerable brain damage, but the perpetrators were never caught. I'm also going to be dropping the occasional exclusive bonus Patreon episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, as we recently released an episode in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed the Aileen Conway case from Unsolved Mysteries, which was also the subject of my debut episode of The Trail Went Cold. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Rebecca I, Wendy M, Michelle A, Michelle M, Mary J, Amanda D, Marnie F, and Hatchet Face. Thank you all so much for your support. Also, provided that it's safe to travel, The Trail Went Cold is only 1 month away from appearing on Podcast Row at the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on the weekend of September the 25th and 26th. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount. So to receive 10% off, visit crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLE21. That's COLE21. Also, even though we're a long time away from the event, The Trail Went Cold has also been added to the lineup for Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets to that event, The Trail Went Cold already has its own specialized promo code. So to get a 10% discount off a standard badge, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶